Rainmaker.fm is brought to you by the Rainmaker Platform, a complete website solution for content marketers and online entrepreneurs. Find out more and take a free 14-day test drive at rainmakerplatform.com.
Hey everyone, Brian Clark here with another episode of Rainmaker FM. Today I have another special guest, someone that I've admired from afar, and yet, as the case may be, sometimes you just don't connect with people even though you're in the same city, at the same conference, whatever the case may be, and that's Michael Hyatt. Now, many of you are probably familiar with Michael. He's done some really great work in the last 3 or 4 years. He is the former chairman and CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers, which I think is like was the sixth largest publisher around. And he was sprung from that position when it was acquired by HarperCollins in 2012. And he did not slow down from that standpoint, as you might have noticed. He is a proprietor of MichaelHyatt.com with the tagline, Intentional Leadership, and we're going to talk a little bit about that concept today. He has a podcast, This Is Your Life, and he's the author of many, many books, more than you probably think, but notably Platform from 2012. He was nice enough to mention me and Copyblogger in that, and we do appreciate that, but first of all, join me in welcoming Michael Hyatt to the show. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing great, Brian. Thanks so much for having me on. As I said to you before the show, I'm a total fan of Copyblogger. I recommend it everywhere I go. It's really helped me in my writing. So thank you for what you do.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. And the feeling's mutual. Like I said, been watching your work in this amazing audience that you've built in not the longest amount of time, really. And I just love it because effectively you're walking the talk. You're practicing what you preach. And that's really what I want to kind of dive into today. Real quick, though, I want to kind of hear, I always ask people from, okay, you were born and we're here today. What happened in the middle there? I did just find out, though, that you went to Baylor. When were you there?
I graduated in 78.
Okay.
So, yeah, met my wife there. And my parents lived there until 2 years ago in Waco, which is the little town outside of Baylor.
Yeah.
So are you familiar with Baylor?
Well, I went to Texas A&M right down the road, but I was there a little bit after you. But, you know, we don't like each other during football season. You know how Texas is.
I know.
It's like its own religion there. So, yeah, I didn't know that. So I found that out. So we did have that that I-35 experience going for us. Okay, so again, you were in Baylor, and then if I understand correctly, you started your career as a literary agent. Is that right?
No, I actually started in the publishing business. It wasn't until much later, about 20 years later, that I became a literary agent.
Oh, okay. Okay, fill me in on that. Okay. Because I missed the gap there.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I was completely enamored with books. I just saw the power of books to really, you know, change a culture, change people's lives. And so I got really committed to books. So I went to work right out of college, actually while I was in college, my senior year, at a local publishing company, small publishing company. And then I ended up going to Thomas Nelson. I was working first in marketing, and then I went over to the editorial side of the business. And then I decided to start my own company. I did that for about 5 years. That company, unfortunately, it essentially went bankrupt. But we were able to sell it, so we kind of avoid all the ugly parts of bankruptcy. And then I decided to be a literary agent, which was a great education. And then after a while, I decided I wanted to get back into traditional corporate publishing. So I went back to Thomas Nelson in 1998, where after several years, I became the president and then the CEO and the chairman and so forth. So all my background is in traditional publishing and traditional media. But in 2004... kind of on a whim, Brian, I started blogging. And I thought, you know, I've always wanted to, I wanted to write more and I wanted to discipline myself to do that. And I thought this might be a way to, you know, kind of express this pent up art that was in me about writing. And so, you know, I was inconsistent and, you know, then I'd go in streaks where I try to be more consistent. But long story short, after 4 years, so from 2004 to 2008, I built up where I had about 1,000 readers a month. So that was good. 1,000 unique visitors.
Right.
then something happened the next year. I hit this inflection point where I averaged that year about 20,000 unique visitors a month. I got picked up by Lifehacker and Huffington Post and a few other sites that really skyrocketed my traffic. And then it's grown exponentially since then. And I was able to step out, as you mentioned, 3 years ago to pursue kind of this growing dream inside of my heart to be a speaker and a writer and create online courses and all of that. So that's what I do today. And today my site gets almost 500,000 unique visitors a month.
Yeah. So absolutely. You're the typical 10-year overnight success.
Yeah.
People always think that, oh, he just came out of nowhere. No, he's been doing it, you know, putting in the work. Yeah, no, that's great. That story is so common. And given also that you were the CEO of a major book publisher at the time, it kind of eliminates the excuse of, I don't have time for this.
Well, I say to people, we talk about that all the time, because when I speak and stuff, people say, well, you know, if I could do this full time like you do it, I would have plenty of time to do it. I'm going to tell you something. This is a dirty little secret. It's honestly harder for me to discipline myself to write now when I'm less busy than it was back then when I was so busy.
I feel the same way. When I am pressed to the limit, I am exceedingly productive. When I have all the time in the world, I get what really needs to get done, you know? But sometimes you're right. You're not pushed to the point where you just go from thing to thing to thing. And it's an odd phenomenon of the human experience, I think. It's interesting to me because you just basically said you've spent your whole life in traditional publishing, traditional media, and that is a space that has struggled and in sometimes has found itself really far behind the curve with this internet thing, even 20 years later.
Yep.
And yet your message was always, hey, the old way is not going to cut it anymore. How did that happen to you? Was it because you had that position of leadership within a traditional media company? You said, I see the change. I see it coming.
Well, what I'd love to say is, you know, I'm a prophet and I saw it all coming and it came out just like I expected.
Go ahead. It's your,
but you know, honestly, when I got involved in blogging and I think really the shift in my thinking happened in 2008 when I got involved in Twitter. All of a sudden, I saw the potential to influence people on a pretty large scale. And it happened to me one time in 2008 when Publishers Weekly, which is the main trade journal in the publishing industry, they did an article about Thomas Nelson and they got all the facts wrong. And so normally what would happen in the old days is I'd write a letter to the editor, I'd complain, and they would do some sort of quasi-retraction on page 32 buried in between everything else. So I said, wait a second. I got a blog, and at the point that article came out, I was getting about 20,000 unique visitors a month, and they had about 20,000 people subscribing to their magazine. And I said, let's forget that kind of old media way of doing this, and I'm just going to write a blog post correcting the record.
Excellent.
And I did.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. I mean, it kind of went viral, and I realized suddenly that I didn't have to go through the gatekeepers anymore, that the playing field was level. And like the lights went off in my head about exploded. And I thought, if I could help authors create a platform where they can get directly to the people that they want to influence and connect with, that would be awesome. Now, at the same time, all this is happening, I'm seeing in my own publishing house is, you know, we've got an editorial process where people submit their book proposals and we review them and we turn down most of them. But with increasing frequency, we were turning down really good book proposals, really well-written manuscripts on the fiction side, all because the authors didn't have a platform. Mm. And, you know, we'd always said, and it's, you know, kind of a, you know, a truth that's often said in the publishing industry, that content is king. But I realized that platform had become queen. And that unless you had both, you really didn't have the same chance as an author that you might have had 20 years ago. But on the flip side of that, you actually have a greater chance. Because now you don't have to rely on somebody to choose you or give you permission. Now you can kind of take the bull by the horns. I think I mixed about three metaphors there, but take the bull by the horns and actually create this platform and connect with the people that want to hear from you. And I think that's just an awesome, unprecedented thing that I still, when I think about it, just makes me go, wow.
Yeah. And you talk about authors with platforms. Wiley is a great example of a house that really grew because it exclusively kind of went after people with existing platforms. And it was just, like shooting fish in a barrel compared to the usual struggle, regardless of how good the content is, to actually get that thing some traction.
That's so true. And it's such a good strategy. We kind of did that even at Thomas Nelson before 2008, because we would identify people that had, large speaking platforms, or maybe they had a television show or a radio show and all that. But the problem with that is that every publisher is competing for those, and it gets very expensive very fast. There's, just supply and demand. But when you start going, and we started intentionally going after this, we started going after bloggers. I remember the first guy I got into a negotiation with was Robert Scoble. Remember him?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And, he's still blogging today. And like he was, I just thought, oh my gosh, this guy's got an incredible platform. We got to publish him. So we ended up losing that book. I can't remember if we lost it to Wiley or somebody else, but we lost the bid. But I had this relationship with Robert, and I saw the potential of that. We ended up publishing Hugh Hewitt, another early blogger. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, if we can go after these guys, they're not even on the radar of most publishers. And the crazy thing? That's even true today. I hear about people, I know like our mutual friend, Jeff Goins, he got his first book deal just because a smart publisher stumbled on his site and said, whoa, this guy's got an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, and we're both friends with Seth Godin, and, get Seth talking about his frustration with the boat that was missed repeatedly by traditional publishing, and, he'll talk your ear off. But it is, I suppose, frustrating, especially when you've been on the inside or Seth's relationship, your relationship there, you probably want to pull your hair out. And I think that's one of the reasons why I just stayed outside of it the whole time. I knew that if I built my own audience, I could accomplish what I was trying to do, and I just have that kind of personality that hates to ask anyone's permission to do anything anyway, Yeah. So let's talk about platform as we approach 2015. I love the fact that you take it back old school, and, if you wanted people to hear you and you had to somehow rise a bit above of the crowd, you could stand on a small wooden stage or literally a soapbox, right, in the square, right, and, draw attention to yourself and have an audience for whatever it is you need to say. Today in the tech media, when we talk about a platform, we're talking about Facebook, Amazon, these masters of the universe, Silicon Valley companies that people do flock to, right? Because it does provide the perception that here's where the people are, so here's where I need to go stand, until you realize you don't own that platform and the rules can change or it can be taken out from under you, not metaphorically.
No.
Right. So what's your thinking these days? What are you telling your people as far as a personal platform? What's the mix of, distribution and ownership?
Yeah, well, I have this model in the book, and I think I originally got this from Chris Brogan and a friend of mine named John Dale, and kind of modified it and created this soup of my own. But essentially, it begins with a home base, your blog or your podcast, but you've got to have a place in cyberspace that you own and control. You can't have happen to you what happened to a friend of mine who was in the conference business. And like 30 days before his biggest conference, he didn't have a mailing list, really. And he didn't really, his blog wasn't that significant. He was doing everything on Twitter and counting on Twitter to get the word out. Mm. And for reasons he still doesn't understand, his account got suspended. And he was essentially out of business. But he didn't control that platform. And when the rug was yanked out from under him, he didn't sell the tickets. It was catastrophic to his business. So you've got to build your house not on a lot that you own. You can't build it on a rented lot. So I think blogging, personally, it's kind of my thing, but I think it's more important than ever. Now, it's cool that we have all these different social media channels, but as it turns out, you still have to have something to say. And I think this is what a lot of people forget, and this is why Copy Blogger is so important, frankly, is because it helps people express it whatever it is they have in a way that's compelling. But just because you have access to these channels doesn't mean anything if you have programming, so to speak, or if you don't have content that people actually want to consume. Podcasting, frankly, wasn't on my radar when I wrote the book. Now it's a huge part of what I do. Podcasting generates probably about half the amount of traffic as my blog does, or the consumption is about half of that. And I think there's probably about a 20% overlap. So, you know, there's just so many opportunities for us to own a place in cyberspace and really set up shop, so to speak, and have our own business.
Yeah, your podcast is really excellent, by the way. Let's talk a little bit about that. So, you know, we obviously share that same text-based, you know, whether you want to call it blogging or not, but the medium that I embraced and felt most comfortable with to start Copyblogger was obviously in writing, and our audience primarily are readers, and yet you cannot dispute that readers to some extent are in the minority, and that audio with its on-demand transportable nature is really too compelling to pass up. When did you start your show, and what was your thinking about, okay, I wasn't thinking about this when I wrote the book, but now I got to do this?
Well, I'll tell you where it began. It started in 2011. And so it was, or maybe it was 2012, now that I think about it, but it was in a conversation with Dan Miller, the author of 48 Days to the Work You Love. And Dan was podcasting. And Dan said to me, "You're missing a huge opportunity." He said, "Everything you just said, Brian, you know, that with increasing frequency, people are listening and consuming media through audio or video, and you've got to be there in a podcast." What he did was give me the vision for connecting with people in a very intimate way. And I know that the reason why sales happen is because people trust you. And the way that people trust you is they have exposure to you and you create a relationship. And I saw that podcasting was an opportunity to do that. Now, I will say this, that after I started, it was a more daunting task than I realized. It became a huge effort for me. I mean, writing, I mean, I've been in periods of my life where I've blogged every day for long stretches of time, and I could do that. But podcasting once a week was difficult. And so I had to learn that. I had to learn how to do the prep. I had to learn to outsource the production. And now the way that we do it is optimal because we batch produce them. I have a co-host now, Michelle, and we do 13 episodes in a day and a half. And
oh, wow. How long? Your shows are like, what, 20, 30 minutes? Or
30 minutes.
Yeah. 13 in a day and a half?
Yeah, can you believe it?
John Lee Dumas does something similar to that, and it's just kind of crazy. How do you keep your energy up?
Well, I personally believe that energy is a caused thing. You know, in other words, if you're sort of aware of it, and I can get through a day and a half. I'm an introvert, so I'll be, you know, crashing after that day.
Exactly, right.
But I can keep it going. And I've got people in the studio that are saying to me, including my daughter who runs my business, says, "Dad, your energy's flagging," or, you know, "Why don't you stand up and do some jumping jacks or run around the block or something, because we need the energy up." So we're conscious of that, but we have to be intentional.
Nice. That is interesting. I'm hearing more and more about the batching approach. I have taken to putting recording time on my calendar, you know, and I can adjust it if I have a guest or something like that, but that something's going to be recorded every day. And to me, that's been working so far simply because it's hard to give up a whole day. And maybe that's just my own limitation. You know how you place, I can't do that. You know, of course you could if you really wanted to, but yeah, that's interesting. Something to think about. So tell us a little bit more about the show and how you positioned it, because it's got a different vibe to it. And yet it all ties together with your body of work.
Well, you know, if I had to criticize myself, you know, if I was a consultant to myself, I'd say you're not niche enough. You're too broad. You're covering too many topics, because I deal with personal development and leadership and productivity and platform stuff and occasionally publishing. But to me, it's kind of all under the rubric or the umbrella of leadership.
Yes.
So there's kind of self-leadership, and then there's team leadership, and then there's public influence. So to me, all those work together. And I've been really intrigued for a long, long time about this idea of how can you succeed at business but not lose at life. And I knew so many people in the corporate world, particularly, that, you know, they had tremendously successful careers, but they were working 80 hours a week. Their health, you know, had fallen apart. Their most significant relationships were, you know, in turmoil. And I said, I just don't want that. And the thing that, as I moved into this online space that I saw, one of the things I got introduced to early was this whole idea of being a lifestyle entrepreneur and really creating a life or a business that serves your life, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I'm just utterly fascinated by that. And I still think, I think that's like the biggest revolution that's happening in our culture right now, is that for the first time, people can be entrepreneurs without having to go raise a lot of capital, without having to take extraordinary risk, and to do it in a way that serves their life. Now, it's going to take some time, and I don't think it's probably wise for most people to just, you know, step out of their job and try to do this. And I didn't do that either. I built it for a long time before I did that.
Yeah.
But it's possible. And that's got to be a first in the history of the world.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and building a software company out of a blog, refusing to write a book against conventional wisdom instead of giving all the content away for free. And yet I never had to raise money. You know, it's doable. And that's why, even though I've never felt comfortable talking about myself, I mean, that was the early days of Copyblogger. It's not about you, it's about them, you know, and I took that very seriously, almost to the point where I didn't realize that sometimes people do want to know a little bit about you. You know, you have to continue to infuse yourself in it. But I suppose that came through no matter what. But you're right, absolutely. And here's the thing that I think is interesting. Even though you do come at things from a rather broad brush, they all do point to this concept of leadership. And I found that, you know, people want to build the audience. They want to have the platform. They want the benefits that come with that. And then yet when you use the word leader, they get squeamish, right? And yet, what else are you if someone follows you? You know, it could be contextual exactly. Leadership. So Seth Godin, I've been following since 99. I can call Seth or email him, but I just read his blog because whatever he's thinking is going to inform me in some aspect. On the other hand, I may need a mortgage and, you know, I go follow someone and see the kind of information they have. And that's a very contextual, transactional form of momentary leadership where I may say, you're the person, right? That's what we're talking about here. It's leadership.
It is. I think anytime you're seeking to influence somebody else, whether it's through your writing or through your podcasting or if you're a public speaker or a book author or whatever it is, you're a leader. And so you might as well own that and you might as well be a good one because we've all known leaders in our lives, whether it was people we worked for or people we worked with that were crappy leaders. And, you know, that also has an impact. You know, the bottom line is, there's a ripple effect. You know, you're going to have an impact. It's either going to be for good or for bad. You're either going to influence people intentionally or you're going to influence them unintentionally in ways that probably won't be good for them and may not be good for you ultimately.
So let's shift gears a bit. I want to talk about Platform University, which is your membership program. Now, obviously, your books, specifically Platform, have propelled your public speaking career. You have live events. I just missed you here in Colorado. I didn't know. I was in Dallas. You're here, you know.
That's crazy.
But you founded Platform University in 2012, almost concurrently or closely after the release of the book. And I think that's so smart because you see authors, they write the book, which is like bleeding a turnip. You know, it's just hard work. They put it out there. And then they're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do next. I remember having a conversation with Tim Ferriss back when, before he became Capital Tim Ferriss. And the book, it was Scobel who really broke that book. Do you remember that?
It was
a blogger who really made 4-Hour Work Week take off. There's a lesson there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But so I was like, I thought I had Tim's business model figured out. I'm like, well, you know, 4-Hour Work Week, this is great, but a lot of this information is very, you know, it evolves so quickly. So you're probably going to follow this up with, you know, a training or a membership site, right? And he just looked at me like, no, I just wanted to write a book. I'm like, oh,
I mean, a huge missed opportunity. And I've recommended that book to so many people. I've probably read through it four times myself. But a membership site for him would have been really cool. And for the rest of us that would like to get the latest, greatest.
Yeah. So did you already have the plan or did it occur to you shortly thereafter?
Once again, no plan. I really didn't have a plan. I didn't even understand membership sites. I think I was a member of a couple. You know, I'm kind of like the guy that subscribes to it and then forgets about it and it keeps it in my credit card.
Right,
and
right.
I keep thinking, I got to get off that. I'm not using it. But when I met Stu McLaren, do you know Stu?
I know the name, but I'm not placing it.
Well, Stu is one of the co-founder of Wishlist Member, which is a big WordPress plugin.
Yes.
For membership sites. Stu met me at a conference where I was speaking with John Maxwell. It was his event. And he said, can I have dinner with you? I never say yes to that. I mean, I'm an introvert. And when I leave the stage, I want to crash. But I said, yeah, for whatever reason. Well, I mean, this guy has become an incredible business partner, but he gave me the idea. He said, you need a membership site and here's what it's possible. If you're serious about helping people at a deeper level, build their platform and really succeed at it, you're not going to do that through a book. You might introduce them to the concept, but let's be honest. How many people follow through after reading a book? All you're going to do is use that as a lead generator to get them into a membership site or a conference where you could really help them and go deeper. So he gave me the vision for it and we launched that. I think we launched it in the fall of 2012. Now we've got about 5,000 members and it's a very robust community and I love it. That's where really 90% of my attention goes these days is in creating the content for Platform University.
Excellent, excellent. So in past shows, we've had some guests and we've talked about various topics related to online courses or membership sites. You know, one topic being, you know, what's the topic? We kind of covered that. And with you, with the book, the topic was obvious. How did you then take the source material and add value? You know, of course, the elaboration is one. Did you go into multiple media formats? Did you create access to you in the form of a forum, all of the above? What was the value add?
Yeah, great question. So what I didn't want to do is just regurgitate what was in the book. And so we divided it up. We said we want new content that's posting every week. And so it's new video content that posts 3 out of 4 weeks. And I'll tell you what we do on the fourth week. So I said, let's do the first week. I love to interview people. So let's have a masterclass once a month with somebody that frankly, I would like to learn from and ask all the questions that I would like to ask. And so that's week one is the masterclass. And so we've had some tremendous guests, Pat Flynn and Amy Porterfield and Dave Ramsey and tons of people there. Second week, we do something called Backstage Pass. And all this is, again, is video. So I have a camera crew from Toronto that comes in once a quarter and we do all this in batch format. But I basically let you look over my shoulder and I teach you how I do something. I mean, this is really how the sausage is made, whether it's, you know, the dashboard that I use and the metrics that I pay attention to, or how I'm able to do social media in 20 minutes a day, you know, that type of thing. Then week three, we do what's called a member makeover. And that's where our members submit their platform to me. And my daughter now does this with me too, but we just do a screen flow screencast where we look at their website, we look at their social media presence, and we just basically critique it for about 30 minutes. It's turned out to be the most popular thing that we do at Platform University because people can then apply it to their own platform. And then in week four, we do a live Q&A call, audio only, but it's usually the topic of the masterclass. Sometimes I have the masterclass guest on that Q&A call as well. And then we do have a forum, a very robust discussion forum as well. So those are the five components.
And just to clarify, it's not just for authors, which kind of I think was your genesis, but you realize everyone selling anything, including themselves, need a platform.
Absolutely. We have financial advisors. We have corporate marketing executives. We have mortgage brokers. We have retailers, insurance salespeople, authors, speakers, coaches, consultants, all the above.
Michael, I think I've figured out why, even when we're at the same conference, we don't see each other. because after each of us speaks, we go hide. Because we're both, it makes perfect sense. I thought I was, you know, the only one, because we do have some extroverts in this industry, and I know we have to tolerate them, but.
I know. I don't see how they do it, because I can fake it for a while. Like, a lot of people think I'm an extrovert and probably.
Well, but it doesn't mean that you're shy or that you can't stand up and deliver. It just means you got to go recharge.
That's it, right there.
Yep. Excellent. Michael, thank you so much for your time. I think this has been instructive. And I know, again, as you said, I wanted to find out more about you. And that's what the fun part of doing these interviews for me. Either I'm catching up with old friends or making new ones and sharing it with the audience. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Keep doing what you're doing. It really matters.
And you as well. Thank you so much.